A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on May 11, 1998, in the series Christian Faith, Interpretations of Experience, entitled Every Family Has a Story. The texts for the sermon are Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 through 9 and 20 through 25, Acts 1, verses 12 through 14, Mark 3, verses 19 through 21 and 31 through 35, plus a reading from Bill Cosby, included here. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
Just before we move to the lessons as listed, I have a lesson from that sage and prophetic figure who gives us a little bit of a reality check on Mother's Day, which can become so sometimes maudlin, sentimental, and unrealistic. This sage is named Bill Cosby. So this is the first lesson this morning. Whenever your kids are out of control, you can take comfort from the thought that even God's omnipotence did not extend to his kids. After creating heaven and earth, God created Adam and Eve. And the thing he said to them was, don't. Don't what? Adam replied. Don't eat the forbidden fruit. Forbidden fruit? Really? Where is it? It's over there, said God, wondering why he hadn't stopped after making the elephants. A few minutes later, God saw the kids having an apple break, and he was angry. Didn't I tell you not to eat that fruit? The first parent asked. Uh-huh, Adam replied. Then why did you? I don't know, Adam replied. God's punishment was that Adam and Eve should have children of their own. Thus the pattern was set, and it has never changed. But there is reassurance in this story. If you have persistently and lovingly tried to give your children wisdom and they haven't taken it, don't be hard on yourself. If God had trouble handling his own children, what makes you think it would be a piece of cake for you? I was given a tape of an interview from National Public Radio, an interview of a novelist, Jim Crace, an Englishman. In the course of the interview, which was about a novel, Quarantine, which he has written recently, which centers in the temptation experience of Jesus in the Judean wilderness, I was struck by the fact that Jim Crace, who wrote the story about the temptation of Jesus, is himself an atheist, and he is a very articulate and intentional atheist. He's not an angry atheist, but he is by conviction a person who believes that the scientific explanation of reality in a purely naturalistic fashion is sufficient for him, and he lives comfortably with that view of the totality of things. But what struck me was his recognition that atheism and a kind of scientific naturalism has failed to develop ceremonies and rituals and celebrations that can elicit awe and wonder from the human person and cultivate that depth dimension in the human person. And where that came out in the interview was the fact that when his father died, who was also an atheist, his father had said, no priest, no music, no ritual, They grew up, of course, in that grand Anglican tradition, which where the liturgy sort of permeates the air. And his father was obviously a very deliberate atheist who wanted none of that folderol at his death and burial. Well, the son felt a lack. But what impressed me was the fact that, once again, the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree. A good, intentional, deliberate, articulate atheist produces a good, articulate, atheist son. You can point to exceptions to that fact, of course, all about you. But the exceptions prove the rule. As a matter of fact, the apples don't fall very far from the tree. And it is, therefore, the claim upon us by our Christian tradition that we keep telling the story to keep the faith alive. And every family has a story. We have a story together, and we have a story individually in our respective families. And on this Mother's Day, when we focus on the family, I do want us to understand how important are our family stories. It's a part of our Eastertide series. As we have been saying these weeks, our tradition, our Christian tradition in our case, is the consequence of a foundational event that finds expression in symbols and images, that is developed into a story that eventually is conceptualized and systematized, but that is really kept alive and is shaping and determinative of ongoing generations by the story itself. We have a story. We keep telling the story. And the generations, one following another, hearing the story, are shaped by the story, and by the story are given lens by which to understand life, to interpret the meaning of human existence. The stories that we have received, that have shaped us, and that we pass along, are terribly important. This is a critical matter. I don't know what would be more critical in the midst of the congregation as we think about being a part of the Christian tradition than to be reminded of the critical nature of storytelling, passing on the faith by reciting the story. We Christians are relative new kids on the block. The Christian tradition came out of the Jewish tradition. And whenever we think about these things, we rather naturally go to the sixth chapter of Deuteronomy, where we have a classic passage. The creed, which had been crystallized and made concise, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. Yahweh, our God, this is our God." That creedal statement is set in the context in which Israel is commanded to love the Lord with their whole being, to keep the commandments in their heart, that is all of the ordinances and the statutes, the rituals, the liturgies, the prayers, all of that that makes up the religious experience, keep it in your heart and recite it. Tell it to your children. Talk to your children about it all the time. Talk to your children as you're going along the way, when you rise up, when you sit down. Put it on the doorposts of your house so that every time you go out, you touch the doorpost and are reminded of the Shema. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one." In other words, be so saturated, so drenched in the consciousness of God, our God, that the whole atmosphere is controlled, conditioned by that spiritual reality. One is, as it were, drenched with spirituality through the cultivation of a consistent, continuous consciousness of God in one's life. And a little kid exposed to that doesn't have a chance. That's essentially what Israel learned, found out. And that's why Israel continues to be a vital reality, a living people today. What are they? Not a race? They're not a tribe. They've become a nation now again, but they're a people. They're a people with a story. And they have magnificently kept that story and all of that religious institution intact, practicing it, observing it, and continuing, thereby, to keep the tradition alive. Jesus was a part of that. Now, as important as it is, we have to recognize on this Mother's Day that that happens in the family. And that happening in the family is not automatic. It is challenging. And it takes the best that is in us. I want us to think a bit today about the family in whatever configuration we find it, and the storytelling, the passing on of the story. We get just hints of Jesus' own experience from the New Testament. Mary in the Gospel of Luke is this beautiful maiden in total submission to the word of the Lord, brought by the angel, that she will bear this one conceived by the Holy Spirit. And then she does everything for Jesus, she and Joseph, according to the law. All of the ritual, all of the requirements, they're all fulfilled. And then the next thing we find is that Jesus is off on his own with his own ministry. And we have a rather interesting episode in Mark, the 3rd chapter, where the word is out that Jesus has gone off the deep end, that Jesus is demon-possessed, beside himself, meaning literally in that day that he had a possession of some kind of spirit. And so Mary and his brothers go off to get Jesus. They want to bring him home. Obviously here there's tension. And there is alienation and estrangement because Jesus doesn't budge. Jesus doesn't move, even though his mother is outside. Mothers have a way of expecting their children to respond, to obey, to follow their word. One of my favorite mother stories is when I presented myself to my own mother for the first time with a beard. I had grown a beard in Europe, and since I couldn't grow it any other place, I thought it looked good. And the day before I came home to see my mother, I shaved it off. I had other problems. I didn't need that one. But after a couple of years on the way to Florida, one day Nancy looked at me, she said, "You didn't shave." I said, "I didn't shave and I didn't bring my razor." Because I thought, you know, one time I needed the whole Atlantic Ocean to separate me from my mother to dare to grow the beard. Now, Florida would be enough distance. But when I got back and she saw me for the first time, she said, "I don't like it, Dick. Shave it off." Now, I'm a grown man. But I can imagine Mary. "Jesus, come home. My mother said, shave it off. I don't like it." Well, I gave her a hug, and then probably another 3 or 4 or 5 weeks, I saw her again, still had the beard. She was quite nonplussed, not really believing her eyes. She said, "I told you to shave that off." Well, Nancy was enjoying it a bit, so she thought she'd add a little fuel to the fire. So she said, this is the early 70s now, she said, "You know what else he's doing now, Mother?" My mother said, "Like, don't tell me." And she said, he's now sitting on a stool to preach. And my mother looked at me like, you know, tell me it isn't true. I said to her, Mother, do you know that Jesus had a beard? She said, he did? I said, yes. And I said, Mother, do you know how he preached? She said, no. I said, well, in the fourth chapter of Luke, he reads the scripture and he sits down to preach. She said, he did? I said, yes. I said, Mother, from a child, you have taught me to be like Jesus, and I'm doing the best I can. But I will never forget the absolute certainty with which she said to me, Dick, shave off that beard. And the next time when I came and hadn't done it, she could not believe I hadn't obeyed. I imagine it was that way with Jesus. He's had a note, your mother's outside. He said, my mother, who is my mother? My mother are those who do the will of God. Kind of glad that John, the fourth gospel, gets Mary and Jesus back together at the cross. Although he speaks of her as woman, it's hardly the kind of thing that warms the cockles of a mother's heart on Mother's Day. That's why I read that little paragraph from Acts, following the ascension, that early community of the disciples gathered, praying, waiting for power from on high. And there's Mary. And there's his brothers and sisters. The reconciliation and the coming together, that's not so easy. It's a very, very difficult thing, as a matter of fact. I think it's part of God's wisdom and perhaps his humor that he makes us live in families. We can choose our friends. Parents are a given. And our children are a given. And our brothers and sisters are givens. And that's why, close as we are, living in that close, intimate proximity, we allow ourselves to be revealed in all of our humanity. And it is in that mix that we have a story to tell. And it is that story that shapes us and forms us. And it's so critically important that we tell the story and pass on the faith. It's the only way it happens. I want you just to think about it this morning, how important that is. We have had a rather unruly worship service this morning. I kind of like high church Anglicanism myself, but I do get misty-eyed when I see those children. And when I see those children, I realize what a treasure is the community in which they are present, and what a responsibility to nurture them, to tell them the story so that the story becomes their story, so that the story shapes them and in turn gives them lens through which to understand who they are, from whence they have come, whither they are going, and what is the meaning of it all. Don't you love the passage in Deuteronomy? When your son or daughter says, what do these things mean? Then you have a teaching moment, that wonderful opportunity. And what do? You don't get out the catechism. You tell the story. You say, our fathers and mothers were slaves of Pharaoh and Egypt, and God set us free. You tell the story. And the story becomes that which is remembered every year, annually, in festival, in ceremony, in ritual. And the story shapes the community and keeps the faith alive. That's so terribly important. Just hear me say that this morning. Now, how are you doing? Not just parents with active children, but parents who've had children long ago and now grandchildren. How are we doing? How are you doing it? How are you doing it? I think it used to be a simpler matter, although maybe it never was an easy matter. For example, when my parents told me the story, they were dead certain there was only one story. You're going to have to tell your children with passionate commitment to the story that it's not the only story. It's our story. It's a story that has shaped us and formed us, in which we find our hope and the grace of God. But we don't want to build walls for them that need not be built or that need later to be torn down. You have to give it proper priority. What is proper priority? Well, I don't know what to tell you. I could make you feel very guilty right now, because who of us doesn't know that we've been lousy at the job? I could tell you stories of years ago when Mr. Bryson on Saturday morning had choir school. I could tell you even more ancient tales of when I went to catechism on Saturday morning. So that the next time you run to the soccer field on Saturday morning, you might think, soccer rather than catechism, soccer rather than choir. I wonder about my priorities. I wish at some point I saw as much commitment to the spiritual nurture of children as I see to soccer on Saturday mornings. But in all honesty, I got to say, the kids to go to school Monday through Friday and then to bring them to catechism on Saturday morning must be a form of child abuse. So as a grandparent, I'm glad that my kids didn't get warped enough to damage their children. But how are we doing it? What are we doing? Are we doing it? Does it have proper priority? And then, do it with passion and grace. That means you don't, like Mary, go rushing off to bring the kid home. Your passion is felt. They've got to feel your passion. But laced with grace. There's a different feel then. And there's a different feel because you are trusting the process, which is another way of saying you're trusting the Spirit. Or let me say it this way. What you do, do for yourself. Be genuine and authentic in your own life and expression. That will be perceived. That will be communicated. That will catch. Sometime, someplace, believe me. And then, let me just say, that what I see in you moves me deeply. I honestly believe my children are better parents than I was. What I see in your families, in the respective arenas in which you live, and in this arena in which children are being nurtured, I see a commitment that is deep and wonderful. And I think you are doing a marvelous job. It must be recognized for the critical nature of which it is. It must be given priority. It must be laced with passion and grace, but I want to say you are doing a really good job, I believe. Parents, grandparents, I see a wonderful commitment to those beautiful children. And I believe that there is grace in the end of it all. You want a nice Mother's Day story? I didn't ask Betty if I could tell the story, but I'm going to tell it anyway, Betty. It's her mother that's going to have surgery tomorrow. It was about, a little over a year ago when Betty came out of church one day and said, "We're going to see my mother, whom I've never seen before." She finally found her mother. And Betty and Norma went down, found her mother, brought her home. And Betty Prerose found out that her name was Elizabeth Grace. What a name. Is it any wonder on this Mother's Day that Elizabeth Grace says, "Pray for my mother"? Because after decades, there is reunion, there is love, there is grace. It's beautiful. Now go out and love each other.